think a transition away from the bongos can take place?
Well, that's still a difficult question to answer right now, in the sense that you will find that some of the Gabonese today are kind of suspicious, because some of them actually think that it may be a plot by France and the Bongo regime to arrange for a fake coup that will just allow for continuity even when the Bongo or the Bongos are no longer there. And so that suspicion is there. Now, how is that possible that we could see something evolving in a way that would make the people trust the coup leaders and at the same time imagine a reconsideration of the relationship between France and Gabon? That's still an unknown, a question that cannot yet be answered. But I can say this. We're seeing all over Africa today discontent, especially in the French-speaking countries that were colonized by France. General discontent, where people have been linking the poverty levels in their nations, the dictatorships that have been suppressing their freedoms, they've been linking that to French control. And now you see when there are demonstrations all over Africa, you know, at least Francophone Africa, you know, the people demonstrating with Russian flags and so on. That's a sign that people are thinking that France is behind whatever is not going well in their nations. And so I think that that's still something that the Gabonese are going to have to grapple with in trying to find out if the coup leaders are indeed genuine and will try to work with the Gabonese people to allow for true democracy to settle in the country in a way that also shows them that they're totally independent from French influence.
So, Daniel Manguera, before we forget, I'm going to go to Thomas Del Tom. Thomas, before we end, if you could also place this coup in the context of the ones that immediately preceded it, and in Niger in particular, and whether you feel that things will change now in Gabon with respect to its relationship to France.
Well, I think there's a difference between the coup in Gabon and the coup in the Sahel, because the coup leaders in Gabon do not seem to want to exploit the so-called anti-French sentiment. They were insiders in the Bongo system. Apparently, the general Oligui Nguema worked with both Omar Bongo and Ali Bongo and benefited financially from his position. One hypothesis is that they knew that the election that took place last Saturday put them in a great danger, and they wanted to intervene before a popular revolt to be able to save what could be saved. I don't know what Daniel thinks about this hypothesis, but I think it is possible that they want to keep the part of the system to continue to enjoy it. On the part of the French, and particularly the French commentators, they tend to play dumb, because they ask questions. If you watch French television, they ask questions like, how come Africans love men in uniform so much, like in Niger and Gabon? How much they wave, how come they wave Russian flags? Do they like Vladimir Putin so much? I think this paternalistic state of mind is quite ill-advised, actually, on the part of the French, because their government and their own indifference for so many years bears a heavy responsibility in what we see now. I think we might be witnessing a second independence, a new decolonization process, and all this pro-Russian feeling in Africa might be more pragmatic than what the French commentators say. And the fact that I think many Africans see the military and the Russians as tools, like pragmatic tools, to get rid of long, like autocrats and the French tutelage. And this is not incompatible with the desire to establish at last a real independence and a real democracy.
I'm going to have Danielle Mangara respond. And also, in the last 60 seconds that we have, where Total, the French oil company, fits into this picture.
Well, the thing is that, you know, what is interesting is that we've actually seen some type of disengagement of, you know, at least French oil companies from Gabon. Today, it's mostly Perenco, which is owned by a French family rather than the French government. And so that's because we actually have a penetration of the Chinese interest in Gabon nowadays also. And that makes it less of a problem in terms of where the relationships, at least the economic relationships, are going, because France is actually now not the main economic partner of Gabon. And that's been a good thing. And I kind of want to echo the idea that, you know, we are now at the, you might say, crossroads. Yeah, that is going to open the possibility that if the coup leaders are genuine about their intent, they're going to have to open up dialogue with the Gabonese civil society and the political class in a way that would allow for the pressures of the Gabonese population, because, and I think that's the key, when we're talking about French influence, it's really about how the people react to the coup leaders and how they can pressure the coup leaders into doing the will of the people as opposed to the will of France. And I think that, you know, the world, the idea of a new independence for Gabon is true in the sense that the potential is there, and I believe we could see something positive coming out of this. I believe that despite the fact that the coup leaders are part of the presidential guard, mostly, the Gabonese will be mature enough to pressurize them, to pressure them in a way that will allow for a national dialogue to occur that could actually open up the possibility of democratic change in Gabon in the near future.
We want to thank you both for being with us. We're going to continue to cover this story, of course. Professor Danielle Mangara teaches French and Francophone studies at Montclair State University in New Jersey, author of Gabon in Danger, the title translated from the French in 1998. Mangara created the exiled opposition movement Bongo Must Leave, which he continues to head. And joining us from Lille, France, thank you so much to Thomas Deltombe, French journalist and essayist. His edited book called A History of France-Afrique, The Empire That Does Not Want to Die. Coming up, Hurricane Idalia has left a trail of flooding and destruction from Florida to the Carolinas. We'll look at the climate emergency with climate scientist Peter Kalmus, the NASA scientist who's been arrested demanding more action on climate change. Stay with us.
La journée est longue, mais moi je ris. La journée est pénible, mais moi je chante. La fin du mois est stérile, je bosse. La fin du mois est stérile, je chante. Mes poches sont vides, je chante. Mes journées sont rudes, je chante. Je chante. Mes doigts sont dansants, je bosse. Je n'ai point de repos. Je n'ai point de sommeil. Mes nuits, des cauchemars, les pleurs des enfants qui ont faim et qui veulent chaque jour un peu plus. Un peu plus. De bon matin, je cherche ma hache. Ma hache mord le bois. Ma hache défie le bois. Ma hache déteste le bois. Et moi, je déteste les...
Pierre Akindenge. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.
Hurricane Idalia has left a trail of flooding and destruction from Florida to the Carolinas, inundating coastal towns and leaving over 300,000 customers across the region without power. Idalia made landfall as a Category 3 hurricane and was later downgraded to a tropical storm. It was the strongest hurricane to hit the Big Bend section of Florida in over 125 years. The storm produced record storm surge across much of the region. As Idalia continues northward, North Carolina residents are bracing themselves for heavy downpours and possible tornadoes. Officials warned residents dangerous storm surges are still possible. Two people died in Florida in car crashes linked to the storm. On Wednesday, President Biden spoke at the White House.
I don't think anybody can deny the impact of the climate crisis anymore. Just look around. Historic floods, more intense droughts, extreme heat, significant wildfires have caused significant damage like we've never seen before.
We go now to Raleigh, North Carolina, where we're joined by Peter Kalmus, climate activist, climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, joining us today speaking on his own behalf, not as a spokesperson for NASA. Last year, he was arrested for locking himself onto an entrance to the J.P. Morgan Chase building in Los Angeles. And you can explain why, Peter Kalmus, you locked yourself to the J.P. Morgan Chase building, how that relates to your climate science work, and what the south of, and the east of the country is experiencing right now, even Raleigh getting the tail end as the storm moves north.
Yeah, thank you. So the public just doesn't understand, in my opinion, what a deep emergency we are in. This is the merest beginning of what we're going to see in coming years. And to me, it's absolutely horrifying. I don't think people really fully appreciate how irreversible these impacts are. We can't just reverse this. It's not like cleaning up trash in a park. How hot we allow this planet to get is how hot it will stay for a very long time. And I feel like climate scientists, including myself, have been being ignored for decades by world leaders. They just don't seem to get this either. I'm glad to hear President Biden finally using his bully pulpit a little bit to try to wake people up that this is real. But he continues to expand fossil fuels at breakneck pace. He continues to permit more drilling on public lands at a pace even faster than Trump to approve the Willow Project in Alaska. He went out of his way to make sure that the Mountain Valley Pipeline, a natural gas pipeline in Virginia and West Virginia, was approved. He could have stopped that, but instead he's pushing to expand fossil fuels. And that's the cause of all of this damage that we're seeing, the deadly fires in Greece, in Maui a few weeks ago, the flooding that we've seen in Vermont this year and Pakistan last summer that basically inundated most of the country. The record heat that we're seeing is going to get worse and worse. I feel like we are on the verge. These are very nonlinear changes. So it feels like they're increasing very quickly because they interact with society in very complex ways. And we're a lot more vulnerable than I think that most people think or thought quite recently. And so we could start seeing things like regional heat waves that end up killing a million people over the course of a few days in coming years. And it won't stop there. That's the thing. It just gets worse the more fossil fuels we burn. And so, yeah, the science, just doing the science, publishing the papers, hasn't seemed to got the message across either to the public or to world leaders. I've got two sons, and it breaks my heart to see the Biden administration continue to expand fossil fuels and take us deeper into this catastrophe instead of trying to bring us back from this. He's deeply on the wrong side of history. Choosing J.P. Morgan Chase Bank in Los Angeles last year, that was a strategic choice because a lot of these new fossil fuel projects, and just let me say again how insane it is that we're still allowing new fossil fuel projects to be built because they have lifetimes of 3 to 4 decades. Anyway, the financing of those new projects is crucial, and no institution on the planet does more damage to the Earth system, irreversible damage, by financing fossil fuel projects than J.P. Morgan.
So, Peter Kalmus, could you talk about that? Elaborate on the role of the fossil fuel industry, not just in, of course, contributing over 80%, being responsible for over 80% of global heating, but what role, if any, it plays in the Biden administration's, despite what he said, that there's no question now of denying the impact of the climate crisis. He's falling short, even though he said earlier this year that he's practically declared a climate emergency. He has not done so. So what would declaring a climate emergency enable? And what role is the fossil fuel industry playing, if any, in preventing him from doing so?
Yeah, so a lot of questions there. Let me start out by saying that the public needs to know that the fossil fuel industry and its leaders, the fossil fuel executives, have and their lobbyists have been lying for decades, for about 50 years. They came, this is very well documented. There's a paper trail. People like science historians like Naomi Oreskes, Ben Franta, journalists like Amy Westervelt, there's a very clear and sizable body of evidence that the fossil fuel industry and through organizations like the American Petroleum Institute have been literally lying to the public, trying to spread confusion about the science, countering climate scientists' attempt to sound the alarm, kind of creating this sense of uncertainty through their lies, spending billions of dollars on these misinformation campaigns, and then bribing politicians. So, I think it was a year ago, a story in the New York Times said that, we all know that Joe Manchin gets a lot of money from the fossil fuel industry. But even Senator Chuck Schumer received almost $300,000 in one election cycle from the corporation that benefits from the Mountain Valley Pipeline to ensure that the Mountain Valley Pipeline was built. So the tendrils of the fossil fuel industry, and it's surprising how cheap it is for them to buy off these politicians. Reminds me of the David Bowie song, The Man Who Sold the World. I know that President Biden, when he was during the primaries, a lot of the people in his campaign team had worked previously in the fossil fuel industry. So there's a lot of connections there as well. So I think that, part of the problem is simply we have one of the most powerful industries on the planet, if not the most powerful industry, which has extremely deep pockets. They have profits of over $1 trillion per year. And they can spend a tiny bit of that money to basically influence politicians. It's essentially legalized bribery. I think there's also their disinformation campaign is a big part of why the public doesn't understand how serious of an emergency we're in right now. And that in turn kind of doesn't push journalists to kind of connect these dots. So I see a lot of stories being reported in the New York Times and elsewhere about these individual climate catastrophes, but they miss very key points in the story, right? First of all, they often use the passive voice. They say, the Earth is heating up. No, it's being heated up by the fossil fuel industry, by their dishonesty, by their legalized bribery. So they don't make that connection. They also don't make the connection of where we're going in the near future, right? So if they're talking about a deadly heat wave that happens in 2023, they don't say how much worse things are going to get by, say, 2028 or 2032. This is what really frightens me about climate change and caused by global heating. It's a trend. You might have some years that are slightly cooler than others due to natural variability. So it's a little bit of a noisy trend, but it's rising year on year. The physics is absolutely, you can't negotiate it with it. We understand the physics quite well. We don't understand how it's all going to play out with these complex human systems like the agriculture system, water systems, geopolitics. That's a whole other question. But we know it's going to get hotter and hotter, and that's going to drive all of these types of catastrophes that we're seeing to get more intense and more frequent.
Peter Kalmus, I wanted to go back to last week's Republican presidential debate. Some are calling it a vice presidential debate. Those who are competing to be the vice presidential running mate of President Trump. But Fox News played a question from Alexander Diaz, a student at Catholic University of America.
Polls consistently show that young people's number one issue is climate change. How will you, as both President of the United States and leader of the Republican Party, calm their fears that the Republican Party doesn't care about climate change?
So we want to start on this with a show of hands. Do you believe in human behavior is causing climate change? Raise your hand if you do.
Well, look, we're not school children. Let's have the debate. I mean, I'm happy to take it to start. Alexander, so do you want to raise your hand?
That was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. He and the other seven candidates refused to say climate change is caused by humans. Vivek Ramaswamy went on to call climate change a hoax. Peter Kalmus.
It's absolutely disgusting to me. I mean, he made a reference to school children. School children understand this science much better than these adult men who are running for high office. And as a parent, as a citizen, and as a scientist, I find it appalling and disgusting. I mean, I can't mince words anymore. I think too many scientists are holding back in how they talk about this. But the science is, there's a mountain of evidence. The science could not be any more clear. There is no debate. It's just ridiculous. And I don't know what else to say. It's like, how would I be able to argue with somebody who insisted that 2 + 2 = 5?
So, Peter, before we end, we just have a minute. What alternatives to fossil fuel are being explored now?
Well, so let's be really clear, right? So as you said earlier, about roughly 80% of global heating is caused by burning fossil fuels. Most of the rest of it is caused by industrial animal agriculture. So, but we know nothing we do will stop this besides if solution packages don't include ramping down fossil fuels very quickly, they're complete basically garbage, right? So look at the COP28 process too. I want to make this point, which COP28 has the last few COPs, the fossil fuel industry has sent the largest group of delegates to. This is the United Nations global negotiations.
20 seconds. Doing.
Yeah, and now it's being led by the UAE National Fossil Fuel Executive. So the fox is controlling the hen house. We have to ramp down fossil fuels. There's no other choice. And renewable energies are already cheaper. So it's just this money in politics which is blocking everything and the ignorance of some of these politicians.
Peter Kalmus, climate activist, climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, not speaking on behalf of NASA, but speaking on his own behalf, and some might say on behalf of the planet. Coming up, we'll look at another crisis, the rapidly shrinking supply of groundwater in the nation's aquifers. Back in 20 seconds.
But you take and you take like silks up my sleeve, tied corner to corner, never ending, trick after trick. I make the magic, and you unrelentingly ask for the secret.
Salt in the Wound by Boy Genius. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
America is using up its groundwater like there's no tomorrow. That's the headline to a major New York Times investigation that examines how the nation's aquifers are becoming severely depleted due to overuse, in part from huge industrial farms and sprawling cities. The depletion of the nation's aquifers is already having a devastating impact. The Times reports that in Kansas, corn yields are plummeting due to a lack of water. In Arizona, there's not enough water to support the construction of new homes in parts of Phoenix, and rivers across the country are drying up.
We're going now to Oklahoma, where we're joined by Warigia Bowman, who has been closely tracking this issue, Director of Sustainable Energy and Natural Resources Law at the University of Tulsa College of Law. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you start off by just explaining what an aquifer is, why these groundwater resources are under such threat, why they're so critical, not only to the United States, but all over the world?
Well, thank you so much, Amy. It's really an honor to be on your show. I've been listening for years, so I'm grateful for the opportunity. For your listeners, an aquifer refers to essentially a container of soil and rock that holds water under the ground. This is not an underground river. Rather, it's water flowing through porous rock and soil. So if you have an aquifer very close to the surface, we usually call that artesian, and that's when you see a spring. So if you see a spring bubbling out of the ground, that means that the aquifer is very close to the surface. Some aquifers are very deep below the surface, and they were formed by glacial rainwater billions and millions of years ago. So an aquifer is just a fancy way of saying, you know, the place that holds our groundwater. Now, aquifers are critical for both the United States and the world because we get so much of our drinking water from groundwater. It's really a significant percentage. In California, it can go as high as 60% in a drought year.
And so, if you could talk about how the federal government and state governments manage public water supplies.
Okay, well, the federal government does not deal with groundwater. They have the power to. The Supreme Court has said in Nebraska versus Spoorhaws that the federal government has that opportunity. But all water law is done at the state level for the moment. And what that means is that each different state has a different approach to managing its water. So actually, who manages water at the local level? That's a municipal issue. That's a little bit more of an infrastructure issue. But in terms of who owns the water and the legal regime to utilize it, that's a state law issue.
And can you talk about how aquifer depletion isn't solely a problem in the west of the country, how the tap water crisis is emerging in other parts of the country as well?
Okay, well, I'm not an expert on the tap water crisis, but I will say that all coastal regions in the United States are really being threatened by groundwater and aquifer problems. Some of the hardest hit are going to be Louisiana and Florida. Obviously, New York will eventually be hit. Let's take Florida. I'm sure you guys have already heard about how residents in Miami are trying to move their properties or find property on hillier areas. But in places like the Everglades, you have a very delicate balance of fresh water and salt water. But when we overdraw our aquifers, then you get something called saltwater intrusion, which upsets that balance. And that's also a serious problem in Louisiana. And surprisingly, under the Mississippi River between Mississippi and Arkansas, there's enormous aquifer depletion. It's hard to believe because the Mississippi is such a big river, but the farmers in that region are withdrawing so much water so fast that actually the aquifers underneath the Mississippi River are one of the most endangered aquifers in the United States.
So, if you could talk about, very quickly in the last minute we have, how the climate crisis worsens this aquifer depletion and accelerates it.
Well, there are a few different ways. The first way is precipitation is declining, snow melt is declining. I mean, snow is declining. But one thing to understand is that aquifers and groundwater, they recharge incredibly slowly. So it can take millions of years to fill an aquifer, but they can be depleted, you know, in 50 years. But as surface water supplies like rivers and streams and lakes are depleted, farmers and industry are going to draw more from groundwater. And so that accelerates the depletion.
Well, Warigia Bullman, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor and Director of Sustainable Energy and Natural Resources Law at the University of Tulsa College of Law. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Hani Masood. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamarie Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, and Emily Anderson. If you want to sign up for our daily digest news in your email box, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information. You have tuned in to Open